Jim Sciutto is CNN's chief national security correspondent and anchor of CNN Newsroom. After more than two decades as a foreign correspondent stationed in Asia, Europe, and the Middle East, he returned to Washington to cover the Defense Department, the State Department, and intelligence agencies for CNN. He has a new book out. It is entitled The Madman Theory: Trump Takes on the World. Trump praises Kim Jong-un and their love notes, admires and flatters Vladimir Putin, gives a green light to President Erdogan to invade Syria. Meanwhile, he attacks U.S. institutions and officials, ignores his own advisors, and turns his back on U.S. allies from Canada and Mexico to NATO to Ukraine to the Kurds at war with ISIS. Trump is willing to make the nation's most sensitive and consequential decisions while often ignoring the best information and intelligence available to him. And he continually catches the world off guard. The question, is it working? Again, the name of the new book is The Madman Theory, and it's a pleasure to welcome Jim Sciutto to the roundtable this morning. A great pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I've been looking forward.
It's very nice to have you here. Let me ask, I should mention, too, that you are going to be in conversation with Daniel Lipman of Politico as part of a Berkshire Ali event at the Berkshire Community College. It's a virtual event. It's going to be online via Zoom. And people can find out more about that by going to BerkshireOlli.org. So what got you thinking about this idea of the madman theory, especially when it comes to our current president?
Well, it's interesting. In covering him for these last 4 years, and actually even during the campaign, you would often hear, and I'm sure folks listening have heard the same, him or his advisors or loyalists say, this is a guy who keeps everyone on edge. He knocks them off balance, art of the deal. He's a disruptor. He comes in and then he figures out how to surprise people, be a little bit unpredictable, get what he wants, right? That's the sales pitch. And, you know, as you saw, as I watched that, you know, come to be, right, with some of America's most severe national security threats, whether it's nearly getting to a war with North Korea or the standoff with Iran, China, as well as his odd relationship with many allies as well. It caught my eye as a theme of President Trump's presidency. And the thing is, he's not the first one to claim the wisdom of a madman theory. Nixon famously coined the phrase and owned it. You know, he's the one who had Henry Kissinger communicate in no uncertain terms to the North Vietnamese that he was just mad enough to launch a military strike on the North Vietnamese to try to gain leverage in those negotiations. Now, that didn't work, but they still owned the strategy. The thing about Trump's rather, is that he unleashes it on pretty much everyone, not just adversaries, but allies, NATO allies, South Korea, Mexico, Canada, and frankly, his own staff. For this book, I spoke exclusively to people who worked for this president, appointed by this president, and they tell countless stories of how he surprised everyone he was working with by making moves in the moment, often against their counsel or against the intelligence that the U.S. had, to change, reverse, upset, reverse again, U.S. policy on a whole host of things. So Trump's madman theory, you know, unpredictable almost by accident, really, and without a key tie, and without a real tie to a big strategy.
That's one of the points that you make, which I think is interesting, that the president employing his own madman theory, that sometimes that's intentional and sometimes it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you an example. One of the chapters is on Syria. So 10 months apart between December 2018 and October 2019, he not once, but twice withdrew all U.S. forces from Syria by tweet. No conversation prior with his national security advisor, with commanders on the ground, with allies on the ground, the Kurds. He just did it. On each occasion, got on the phone with the Turkish president. Turkish president, frankly, plays him on the phone and tells some stories of how that played out. And he comes off and says, tweets out that we're out of Syria. So madman unleashed on his own advisors and allies. Interestingly, though, and this is another dynamic here, that for all his perceived strength and bluster is often undermined by the people who work for him, or just forgets about things he does, kind of moves on. So after that first withdrawal from Syria, Pentagon, said this is a bad idea. And they calculated that they could withdraw a few hundred troops, but not all the troops, and hope that he just lost interest. And he did, until 10 months later when he withdrew again. And in that instance, they thought the gig was up. Then they came up with an idea. They said, how about we tell him the troops are really there now to protect the oil fields? That'll appeal to him because it's got an economic aspect to it. And that worked that time. They withdrew a few hundred more, but U.S. troops are still on the ground in Syria. So you see a whole host of dynamics here that, you know, there's a lot of false power that he assigns to himself.
That idea of what the role of the advisors are and those around the president is fascinating, as you write about, because they seem to realize what's happening in real time. And then how to, A, get out of it, and B, to try to convince the president to do something else, or, as you point out, to water it down.
The sad fact is there are fewer and fewer people willing to do that because the president has successfully exiled, shamed out of office, or fired the few folks who were in senior positions who had the power and the will to contradict him. You know, Jim Mattis, he resigned after that first Syria withdrawal. Others have followed. So there are fewer who are willing to stand up to him. And you see that, for instance, in the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Europe. Not all of them, but a big chunk of them from Germany. Again, a move not recommended by anybody who works for him, not a single ally, no one in the Pentagon, Republican or Democrat, frankly, right? Lawmakers, none of them supported this move. But in the year 2020, Pentagon just does it, right? And with real consequences, a big chunk of those forces leaving Europe for good. And you kind of scrambled the U.S. position in Europe on a number of fronts. So it's become less likely that he is counteracted or slowed down or watered down in any way as he has watered down any sort of opposition within his own administration.
The idea that those around him don't want to give him military options because, as you write, they are worried that the president may actually take us to war.
Yeah, this is one of the more disturbing, shocking, whatever you attach the right adjective to it, phenomenons here. And this happened more than once. So this speaks to just a larger distrust in the president's decision making from his own advisors. But in late 2017, at the height of tensions with North Korea, you'll remember this was the peak of fire and fury. It was after North Korea had had their sixth and largest nuclear test. There was genuine concern in the Pentagon that the president was mad enough to take the country to war there, to the point where they hesitated to give the president military options. And remarkably, in the midst of that, communicated to their North Korean counterparts that they didn't know what the president was going to do out of concern that there would be misreading and those two countries could end up in a very bloody war. You remember this concept of a bloody nose strike on North Korea. The fact is, no one in the Pentagon believed such a thing existed because even a limited strike would likely be viewed by the North Koreans as the beginning of a decapitation strike. And they would react self-defensively by raining hellfire down on Seoul, which they have a capability of doing. You know, the intel estimates of how many people would die in such a limited, quote unquote, limited military exchange was tens of thousands, right? Of South Koreans there, as well as many Americans live in the Seoul area, including soldiers and their families. So they hesitated there and took that remarkable step of communicating that concern to their counterparts. It happened again with Iran in 2019 at the peak of hostilities with Iran, where you had U.S. military officials and diplomats again finding a way to communicate to the Iranians that they really didn't know what the president would do next because they worried about getting on an escalatory path to war. It's a remarkable indictment of the commander-in-chief's decision-making from the inside.
Just looking at the relationship that you read about this in the book, of course, the relationship between President Trump and Kim Jong-un is going from Little Rocket Man to The Two of Us Fell in Love. I mean, it's odd, but it's also disturbing when you're thinking that that war could be an option.
It is, and it happened in in a number of the most top line national security issues. Of course, the concern now is what path the U.S. is on with China. You know, I talk a lot in the book about how this is the thing about this is I tried to take a look at Trump's foreign policy with an open mind. Where did it work? Where didn't it work? And I tell a personal story in here because I've spent years covering China, living in China, dealing with China during my brief time in government. And I've been a firsthand witness to China's bad behavior on a whole host of fronts, including talking to dissidents who've been tortured by that government. So standing up to China is something that just personally I welcome, and you can see the argument for, because for so many years the U.S. was not willing to do that. The trouble is we're on such an escalatory path right now that even some of the China hawks within his administration are concerned that this is happening without an endgame. Steve Bannon, in the book, who I also interview, talks about the possibility of war with China in the next 5 years. That would be an ugly war, you know. And this raises a larger question about each of these stands that the president has taken or not taken, you know, with a Russia, for instance, but stands he's taken against North Korea or Iran or China. Is it's hard to impossible for his advisors to describe what the strategy is. What is the grand strategy? And oftentimes the president's moves are actually contradict what the stated U.S. national security policy is. For instance, taking troops out of Europe, right? The focus now in the stated U.S. national security policy is to beef up the U.S. presence there to be a deterrent to Russia. He's doing the opposite. It is the stated U.S. policy to warn Russia away from interfering in this upcoming election. The president won't do it. What is missing almost across the board is a grand strategy beyond just acting or looking tough.
Yeah, I mean, you tweeted about this last month and saying that this rapid escalation in U.S.-China tensions is real and concerning, and comes, as with all things Trump, the question, what is the endgame? And that we just don't know that. We don't know what it is for the president and ultimately for a United States foreign policy.
We don't. And I gave folks a chance to describe that strategy, right? And it doesn't mean that there's no philosophy to it, right? There is a sort of Trump philosophy, and it's basically a transactional one. That is the word that was most common in describing his policy. It's basically, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and that goes for adversaries and allies. And this has led him, in some ways, to have his biggest, most consequential stands against some of America's closest friends, and forgetting or ignoring or not understanding all the ancillary benefits of long-term alliances. Right? H.R. McMaster talks in the book a lot about how he couldn't get through to Trump that alliances matter beyond just a simple financial bottom line. There's intelligence sharing against terror groups. There are shared values. There's a shared interest in the rule of law, in democratic principles. But these are things that the president doesn't get, either doesn't believe in or doesn't get. And it's really both of those things. He's got a very, one of the chapters is the end of American exceptionalism, because in Trump's view, the U.S., no one's better than anyone. You're all power players in a zero-sum game. And that's a remarkable re-envisioning of America's position in the world.
You write about this in The Madman Theory, and the term shock and awe diplomacy is used, and how bullying may work in as a power play in a negotiation with Democrats, but when it has to do with China and their very existence, it doesn't.
This is the thing about the China policy. And again, what is the goal here? You're not China into fundamentally changing its system or its way of life. It's you could stand up. What are you negotiating for? Are you negotiating for concessions or an endless conflict? Because, it's interesting. The essential Trump position is we're going to bleed China, right? We're going to take the supply chain out of China. We're going to do it ourselves. We're going to move it to other countries. We're going to pressure companies to move it out of China to other countries in Asia, in effect, starving the Chinese economy. Now, whether that's justified or not, you know how China views that. They're saying this is existential for us, so we're going to fight back. And it's interesting, speaking with Anthony Scaramucci the other day, Republican former member of the administration, he was making the point, and this is a good one, China has other elements of leverage on the U.S. Half of GM's worldwide sales are in China. When I was in China, the Buick is the Cadillac of China. Chinese buyers love the Buick. They've got a great market there. China could easily shut that down. Boeing's big growth market going forward is China. Well, China now makes its own plane. So Boeing without China, whether you think that's, a justified price to pay, it is a price to pay. In any assessment of what's working for us as a country, you have to factor, that in. You have to factor that all in. And factor in that, from their perspective, they're going to fight back, right? And you got to be prepared for that.
So in 2.5 months, we go to the polls and we'll look to elect the next president of the United States. So the question I have for you is, how much of this is lasting damage, and what if Trump loses? When it comes to foreign policy, how much work is ahead of a Joe Biden administration in making those things right? Another question of does it give some latitude for others to employ a madman theory?
Others meaning adversaries.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, let's start with what is lasting from this. Whether Donald Trump's presidency ends in January of 2021 or 2025, some of these changes can't be reversed in a day or in a year or perhaps ever. I hate to say ever, but think of alliances, right? Alliances are only as good as in how much people believe in them, both the people who take part in those alliances, but also the adversaries who challenge them. And the president has raised questions not just about the finances of NATO, right? But he's raised questions about, the essence of it, which is a mutual defense treaty at the end of the day. One where an attack on any member is an attack on all members. This is the Article 3 that was invoked after 9/11, right? Those NATO allies said, we're with you, and went to fight the war in Afghanistan against Al-Qaeda and Taliban. In addition to the support for the rule of law, free and open economy, shared democratic values, etc. He's raised questions about whether we believe in that, right, as the goal of NATO, and really are committed to defending all from any attack abroad. So you have a new president. Do they believe he'll abide by it? You've raised questions about it, and Russia's certainly looking for fissures in NATO, and they've celebrated the fissures in NATO. Those will take time to repair. But it's raised a question about the U.S. commitment to other alliances as well. The president right now is squeezing South Korea to quintuple its contribution to U.S. military forces on the peninsula, and threatening at the same time to withdraw U.S. forces from there, even though you're in the height of tensions with North Korea. It raises a question, is the U.S. good for its treaties anymore? And, okay, let's say you have a new president in November. What will the next president do? The U.S. politics are so split and divided, the pendulum swings pretty broadly. Maybe that alliance is good for 4 years, but will it be good for the 4 years after that? Beyond that, you look at Iran. The U.S. signed a treaty with its allies in China and Russia for the Iran nuclear deal and then immediately pulled out of it. Who's going to believe the next president's commitment to another deal, whether it's Trump trying to sign a new Iran deal or trying to work something out with North Korea? How do they know he sticks to it given his track record, or that his successor does. Those things are hard, you know. Those genies, those genies of doubt are hard to squeeze back into the bottle.
Right. And another 4 years seems concerning, given that what few checks and balances there were would seem to go away in many cases in a second administration.
It is. I mean, you hear that, and this is echoed by some of the people I spoke to for my book. But, you know, John Bolton, you know, has expressed that openly, saying he fears that Trump would up and pull out of NATO in a second term. You know, and even if he doesn't go that far, he would inevitably view re-election as approval of a whole host of things that he's done. I mean, you know, the likelihood of no more forces on the ground in Afghanistan. You know, you can make an argument for that. They've been there a long time, but who's then going to keep a lid on Al-Qaeda there, which still exists and still wants to blow up U.S. airplanes? You know, I've spoken to the counterterror officials about that, that desire and capability has not disappeared. So yes, a second term would carry this country and that administration further down that path. And that's something and it's one reason why we put this book out before the election, is so that people, as they're making their choice, realize that these decisions have consequences. They're broad ones and lasting ones. And then the other piece too is just the broader attack on and undermining of institutions. You know, I write a lot about in the book about, you know, beyond the public attacks on the intel community, FBI, etc., now the U.S. mail system, beyond the attacks on that, and the news media, by the way, you know, the president has dismissed and you know, really destroyed the national security policymaking process. He doesn't. There is no policymaking process. It follows the president's tweets and decisions. So, all these institutions and advisors and area experts who are built to inform the president's decisions have been downgraded and ignored. It's, you know, the policy is the man, and the man is the policy. That's a remarkable way for the most powerful country in the world to operate.
Well, the book is really something, and just should be required reading. It's The Madman Theory: Trump Takes on the World. It's published by Harper. A reminder that Jim Sciutto will be in an live online conversation about Trump's foreign policy as part of Berkshire Alley, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, with Daniel Lippman on Wednesday, August 19th at 7 o'clock, and you find out more by going to BerkshireOlli.org. Jim Sciutto, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much. I'm a great fan of your work and your journalism, and I appreciate you being on our program.
That's kind of you to say. I really appreciate you taking the time, and to all the folks who are listening, thanks for giving a chance to hear the story of the book.
Thank you very much. Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, the name of the book is The Madman Theory. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.